I am Kate Schimmel. I'm High Country News' digital editor. I'm here with Tay Wiles, our associate editor, who's been covering the Bundy standoff trial in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Tay.
Hey, Kate.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit. You've been there for the first week of the trial, and I wanted to hear what happened this week. What exactly did they do during the first week?
So the first week, there were 3 days in court this week, and it was 2 days of jury selection and then 1 day of opening statements that in which the defense attorneys and the prosecutors each get to make statements. So at this point, there is a jury set, and next week we'll hear from witnesses.
So for listeners who might not remember the details of the 2014 standoff, can you tell us a little bit about what happened out there on the Bundy Ranch?
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked the question. I think that in order to understand this trial, we should take a step back and just remember that this is a decades-long battle between the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, and cattle rancher Cliven Bundy in Clark County. So in 1993 was when the BLM first offered Bundy a 10-year grazing permit to limit impacts on the threatened desert tortoise that he declined. And in 1994, the BLM takes the case to court because he won't sign a permit or pay his fees or remove his cattle. In 1998 was when the U.S. District Court of Nevada finds Bundy guilty of trespassing and bans him from grazing. In 1999, Clark County Conservation Program closes the whole area to grazing. In 2012, the BLM planned a roundup of his cattle but called it off because there was a risk of violence. And then in 2013, a U.S. District Court of Nevada reaffirms that he must remove his cattle. And then a year later is 2014, when we had the standoff between Cliven Bundy and armed supporters from other states around the country who came to support him in his fight against the BLM. So the BLM had attempted to round up his cattle, and they did round up several hundred head, and they backed down and let them go after they were after they encountered the armed protesters.
So this all started because Cliven Bundy had a bunch of cattle grazing in an area that was critical to an endangered tortoise. So that's kind of the root of what brought us to here. And when they asked him to follow the rules and apply for a permit so that they could properly assess the impacts, he declined.
That's correct.
Okay. And then that escalated over the course of about 20 years to the point where a bunch of Bureau of Land Management agents were facing off with anti-federal government protesters with weapons.
That's right.
So one of the things that I thought was striking, and one of the images that circulated, was of this guy lying on an overpass with a sniper rifle pointed at federal agents. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
So that's Eric Parker, who is from Idaho, and he's one of the six defendants in this first trial. This is the first of three trials that are related to the 2014 standoff, and he is one of the defendants who's in the courtroom this week. He had come from Idaho with some other people to support Cliven Bundy. What's interesting about him and a couple of the other defendants that defense attorneys brought up this week was the reason why they decided to come down was varying ideologies and beliefs that they held, but also three things that they saw on the internet that really made them get in a car and drive down to Nevada. One was an image of an older woman being thrown to the ground by what appears to be a BLM officer. Another one is what appears to be a son of Cliven Bundy being tased. And another one was a photograph of an area that had been blocked off near the impoundment area that was labeled First Amendment area, I think. These are the things that sort of made the rounds on YouTube, made the rounds on Facebook and Twitter, and really made people angry, people like Eric Parker, and made them get in a car to drive to Nevada, despite the fact that they may or may not know much about the BLM or ranching or grazing fees or things like that.
I think it's pretty interesting the way the internet has stoked so many of the flames in this movement. In the national news, we've been seeing a lot about alt-right, about white nationalist sympathizers, and about a kind of anti-federal organizing that I think may feel unfamiliar to people who haven't been following the blow-by-blow of the Bundys. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that broader movement or broader sentiment that Eric Parker and Cliven Bundy are a part of, and how it's playing out right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that many details about Eric Parker as an individual. Maybe we can talk more about him and more details on the defendants next time we talk. But in the larger sense that you're talking about, this is a really interesting development over the past few years in which people like Cliven Bundy, whose families have been ranching Western landscapes for many, many decades, and who may sort of be part of this movement called the Sagebrush Rebellion, which started in the late 70s, in which legislators started trying to pass legislation to transfer federal land to state control. I would say Cliven Bundy definitely adheres to that belief and that ideology that should happen. So he's sort of what we might call a more traditional Sagebrush rebel. But the standoff that happened in 2014, he and his family members and other close supporters called on a much wider group of people across the country who were not traditional Sagebrush rebels but may be involved in quote-unquote militias or self-styled patriot groups. They put out the call, and a lot of these people came to the standoff to support Cliven Bundy. So it's the coming together of these two separate movements that we've seen really play out on public lands in the West in the past few years.
Right. So we have social media and we have the internet really stoking these flames, and then we have an anti-federal management, anti-federal government control movement on the other hand, and those two things coming together. I would love for you to tell us just a few of the questions that you heard people asking during jury selection. So when they're picking out the people who will decide whether people like Eric Parker are guilty, what are they looking for?
That's right. Yeah. It was pretty interesting this week. So of course, the judge is looking for people who can fairly weigh the facts and who haven't already formed an opinion on this case and on these defendants and on the standoff. So they're sort of looking for people who are smart and meticulous but are uninformed about this huge national news story. So that's what they're looking for. But the defense attorneys and the prosecutors obviously are also trying to find people who might be sympathetic to their side. So some of the questions that defense attorneys asked were, where do you get your news? Where do you get your information? Do you get it from newspapers? That was one question, and two people out of dozens of potential jurors raised their hand that they get the news from newspapers. A lot of people said they got it from TV, social media. So then a defense attorney asked, okay, do you get it from Fox or CNN or MSNBC? And from there, he sort of weighs which of those people he would want on the jury. So there's a lot about media. Another question that came up a lot was, how do you feel about guns? How uneasy do they make you, if they make you uneasy at all? Most of the potential jurors that were circulating in the courtroom this week who were specifically asked said they either were a gun owner, grew up with guns, or were not uneasy with guns at all. And then the third question that was asked a lot was, how do you feel about protests and the First Amendment? And there were a lot of references made to the civil rights movement and women's suffrage, and the women's march following the recent presidential inauguration. A lot of attorneys were asking potential jurors, do you believe in protest? Do you think it's a worthy cause?
It's pretty fascinating the way this trial with, you know, seven people who most people don't know is just a reflection of so many of the tensions going on at the national level right now. I wanted to move on to opening statements. Were there any takeaways that we should know about in opening statements so that we can kind of understand where this trial is going? Were there any big...
Mm-hmm. Both prosecution and defense attorneys let the jurors know that they'd be seeing a lot of social media as evidence. There would be a lot of videos and photos and other pieces of social media, which I thought was interesting. I think, you know, it could play to both sides depending on how they present it. That's one thing to expect. And I guess one of the biggest takeaway from the opening statements was how different the pictures were that the defense and prosecution painted of the standoff that day, April 12th, I believe it was, 2014. The prosecution painted it as BLM and National Park Service officers doing their job, trying to fulfill a court order to impound cattle and being afraid for their lives when they encountered the protesters. And then the defense attorneys tried to paint it in the opposite fashion as these men who had come there to stand up for what they believed was right. One of the defense attorneys compared his defendant to Jesus Christ at one point, saying that he was a man who stood up for what he believed in. So that was interesting to see the contrast there. And I'll say one other thing about opening statements is one of the defense attorneys did try to distance his client from Cliven Bundy himself, saying, this is not a Bundy trial. There is not a Bundy trial in these six defendants here. Cliven Bundy isn't here. And we really need you to weigh the facts according to what these defendants here did, not Cliven Bundy.
Well, thank you so much, Tay. And we'll be talking to you as this trial progresses and then subsequent trials related to the Bundy standoff in 2014 progress. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Kate.